From 26th Psalm, a song of ascent. When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dreamed. Our mouths were filled with laughter, our tongues with songs of joy. Then it was said among the nations, "The Lord has done great things for them." The Lord has done great things for us. And we are filled with joy. Restore our fortunes, Lord, like streams in the Negev. Those who sow with tears will reap with songs of joy. Those who go out weeping, carrying seed to sow, will return with songs of joy, carrying sheaves with them.
Thank you. Since my degree is in theology and not biology or chemistry, I have to trust people who are much smarter than me when they say that 99% of the mass of our human bodies is made up of just six elements: oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, calcium, and phosphorus. Does this periodic table make anyone else nervous? Harkens back to my high school days, and glad it's behind me. If you tack on five more elements, potassium, sulfur, sodium, chlorine, and magnesium, now you're up to 99.8%. And we've just named the 11 elements that are necessary for human life as we know it. The other 0.2% of our bodies is comprised of 49 other elements that are hardly worth mentioning other than they're there in trace amounts. Some of those 49 are just innocent bystanders with no specific function. We're looking at you, beryllium and samarium. Some can become toxic when amounts are somehow elevated, like mercury, for example, or lead. And did you know that there are microscopic smatterings of gold floating around inside of you? Not enough to retire on, unfortunately, but one can dream, right? In our bodied selves, we make up 2/3 of all known elements, which is nothing short of a complete amazement when you consider it. We are like walking periodic tables. We are stunning miracles breathed into. Then there's this nugget of information. Most of the elements needed for life are also relatively common in the Earth's crust. Meaning, what's in us, what we are made up of, also makes up the dirt located underneath this very building and the compost pile next to your garden, and the mud on the sidewalk you have to jump over to get to your car. I'll leave it up to you if you want to declare some kind of kinship with the soil beneath your feet, but the next time we hear phrases like Mother Earth and tree hugger, humility is probably a decent path to take. But as I said before, I am a minister and not a biologist, and so I'll not dabble too long in matters I don't understand and move rather to things I kind of, sort of, maybe on some level do understand, though some days are better than others. For 3 weeks prior and today being the fourth Sunday in a row, we've been tossing around the word Lent. Lent comes from a word that means spring, as in springtime, as in the behind-the-scenes leafing of trees at the park and the almost but not yet budding of the plants in your flower bed. Lent for Christians mirrors the movement from winter to spring as we make our way to Easter morning when Jesus the Christ will rise up from among the dead. We are called to recognize that there are dead places within us and around us. And we are called to a confession that resurrection is our greatest need. Along the way, as we pray and seek God's newness in us, we are emptied of false notions such as personal wayfinding and individual grandeur. The Lenten mantra, if there is one, it goes something like this. From dust you are, and to dust you shall return. From dust you are, to dust you shall return. It harkens back to Eden's garden, where God says to Adam, by the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. From dust you are, and to dust you will return. Your body, as Genesis hints and as chemistry teaches, is made up of the stuff of the earth, all oxygen and carbon and hydrogen, and when your body dies, it becomes one with the earth again. It's a sobering thought to be reminded every single year, cycling back around to Lent, that we started out as dust, and dust is where we will end up. Though the older our bodies get, the less reminding we need. If we have forgotten, or if we try to forget, then today's psalm brings our dustness back up to the surface. It's an odd poem. It's only 6 verses long, tucked away somewhere in the mid-120s. It certainly does not get as much notoriety as its more famous siblings. And to put this text in the lectionary at all is like choosing a book at random off the shelf and cracking it open and giving it a shot. This section, as Kay mentioned earlier, is found in a part called the Songs of Ascent. Basically, that's a collection of 15 psalms that the people of Israel would use as they went to Jerusalem for yearly festivals. Since Jerusalem was located at a higher elevation than the surrounding area, they would have to ascend to get there. They would chant these songs as they marched upward to Zion, that beautiful city of God and that temple located there, a song of ascent. Here's how ours begins, what Kay read for us. When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with shouts of joy. Then it was said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us, and we rejoiced. A lot of folks who study the Psalms believe that this one right here was written after the people returned to Israel after 7 decades in forced captivity hundreds of miles away from their homeland. God rescued His people and brought them back to the place promised and given them their place, which He had given them centuries before. No longer were they enslaved. No longer were they far from home. They were free again with a renewed vision and focus and relationship with God. And Zion itself, the great Jerusalem, had been returned to its previous condition before local corrupt leaders and foreign armies brought its downfall. It was God who restored beyond the people's abilities. The Israelites were not shy about claiming that one. So of course there was happiness, and of course there was laughter. Of course the other nations recognized what the Lord had done. Of course Israel rejoiced. How could they not write songs and poems about it? God was doing amazing things among them, building and rebuilding what people could only imagine in the far reaches of their minds. The people remembered all that, the full rescue, the full restoration, the full houses, the full treasuries, the full place of worship. The Lord has done great things for us. How good that time was. Remembering God's prestigious acts and telling stories of what God has accomplished has the ability to enthuse and bolster a faithful people. The Lord has done great things. Yes, we say. Thanks be to God. A few years ago, while at my parents' place in Granbury over Christmas, we watched some old home movies that had not been watched in a while. My dad had transferred all the old VHS tapes onto a digital copy, placed it on DVD. On the screen, there I was, elementary-aged and dimple-cheeked. My brother with his thick glasses on, my sister with her two front teeth missing, my parents, young, not much older than I am now, my grandparents, vibrant and alive. In those moments of looking back, I saw the truths of how priceless those moments were. I remembered with great affection seeing up on that screen the memories that I could recall inside my head. And I thought, those were really good days back then, and they were. Yet there was also a genuine sadness as I watched, because it's not like that anymore. I am no longer a little boy with dimples. My brother now wears contact lenses. My sister has a full set of teeth. My parents are in their late 60s. My grandparents are buried. Things have changed. The double-edged sword of remembering is that evoking all those long-ago memories can descend into a kind of unbridled nostalgia. In our psalm today, all of God's mighty acts are in the past. All of the God-actioned verbs are past tense. When God restored, then we laughed. Then the nations said, we rejoiced. And this is good. Again, we need stories of the past because they can sustain and uplift and encourage like few things can. We need those stories given in the right context. The trouble begins with misplaced wistfulness. Thinking and hoping and wish dreaming that life could just, for the love of God, go back to how things once were. Is that too much to ask? Individuals do the same thing, attempting to turn back the clock on what seemed to be easier days. I just wish I could keep my kids as kids forever. I just need to get back to being me. The world was a simpler place back then. And churches are not immune either, especially ones that have been around a long time. You hear sometimes embellished stories about the golden age of a congregation. Back when they had this many people and that many activities and volunteers to spare and cash to pay for everything they wanted and more. Nowadays, faith communities that once had rooms full of laughter are half empty. Tongues of joyful singing that fill the worship space have become a more muted worship experience. They meet in elderly buildings located in parts of town where the local economy once prospered. But the money flow in the neighborhood both changed over the last decades, and therefore so has the church. True or not, some Christians can remember the trouble-free and better days when it seemed that God was doing great things for them, things that you could touch and smell and taste right there in front of you. Great stories are told of these times, praiseworthy stories. But one must be aware that unbridled nostalgia runs the risk of doing more harm than good. Because there is a risk concealing at what the core is truly going on. Lament. Lament. This public expression of deep grief for communal loss. This weeping that what once was is no more. By the time we hit the second half of the psalm, the mood shifts from happiness and rejoicing to expressed sorrow. In the blank slide between verses 3 and verses 4, some predicament has happened, or some kind of disaster. Between verse 3 and verse 4, we've stepped out of the happy past and into a present crisis. There is mourning and there is sadness. Just as quickly as joy blossomed, it has retreated back into a dehydrated square one. Unlike our tendency to do so, Psalm 126 does not mask the people's lament. There's no pretending they are fine. How are you? Fine. Everything good? Yep. Psalm 126 does not do that. It brings lament directly to the forefront. Restore our fortunes, O Lord, like the streams in the Negev. Same words as verse 1. When the Lord restored the fortunes in Zion is found here in verse 4. Restore our fortunes, Lord. The Negev is a wilderness with dry riverbeds crisscrossing an arid land, and they will remain dry until the seasonal rains come and fill the streams once again. That is a prayer of hope. Once these streams held water, they can do it again. Once God restored Zion, God can do it again. To end the dryness and bring back laughter, it's a sensible request of God, is it not? Since God has promised to always provide and to always be near, what better way for God to be near than to return the things to how they were before this mess began? The unforeseen twist in this psalm comes in verse 5. As a result of the prayers of the people, we could have envisioned the gathering of dark clouds to the west, heavy with rains, ready to replenish the barren creeks. What we get instead is a person crying. Those who sow in tears reap with shouts of joy. The water that God will use to renew the bleak landscape of circumstances will not come from the skies, but from the eyes. Strange as that sounds, the psalmist goes on to double down on his claim. Those who go out weeping, bearing the seed for sowing, shall come home with shouts of joy, carrying their harvest. Now, I don't know about you, but I've been in enough hospital rooms to know what the bitter sobs of anguished wailing sounds like. I have sat with enough people in unbearable situations to know the distressed rhythm of weeping and heaving shoulders. I have cried enough privately to know how tears can discolor Sunday morning shirt sleeves. In those moments, the furthest thing from my mind are shouts of joy or questionable spiritual teachable moments like, God is doing this for a reason. What possible harvest can be carried home when your swollen tears make it hard to see anything life-giving at all? The psalmist is undeterred, however. It's like he believes that when weeping is not denied, when weeping is not shunned, when weeping is not withheld, that God will eventually redeem it and transform it into a means of goodness. Tears, he says, will indeed become the shower that will bring about fruit in desert places. How exactly is a great question, and one that should be asked of God, and maybe God will answer. In the meantime, even if the answers don't come immediately, You and I can both look over the journeys of our lives and pick out the utter worst moments or months or years. We try to heal ourselves by scattering whatever helpless seed we had in our pockets, hoping without hope that something would stick the landing, that one of them would take roots, that any kind of healing would take place. But most of our efforts resulted in nothing. But some made us feel different, at least, like getting out of bed, or talking to a trusted person, or confessing sin, or returning to community, or giving something away. It wasn't until later or much later that we started to notice little seedlings popping up from the dirt. There is no way, you might have thought then. You may have had to get down on your hands and knees to view it, but it's true. Look, there it is. A path out. An interview granted. A friend appearing, a twig of justice here, a window opened. God took the reason out of this is happening for a reason and started instead to do something new. After a while, because of mercy and because of seasons, there came a yielded harvest that you never could have anticipated or dreamed about. And at some point, you realize the words of Jesus had become a deep truth for you when he said, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted." A fresh happiness you did not expect replaced the old sorrow you still bear the scars of. And you can't help but sing with shouts of joy. Praise be to God for that. If the hands and knees posture is where you find yourself these days, there's some greening evidence of all the clumsy sewing you've been doing, then the prudent thing to do, as any farmer would tell you, or any wise Christian would recommend, is to not rush the poor thing. Don't harvest it too soon. Don't pull it up by its roots and hold it in your sanitized hands. Don't run around showing everyone how quickly a magnificent crop just came for you and how you are much better now. Thank you very much. Simply let it grow and give it space. Give it time and water it with more of your tears. Pray over it with more of your wordless prayers. Shouts of joy will come. Whispers of wonder are good enough for now. If where you find yourself instead is face down on the ground, with your cheek against the hard earth, fixing your eyes on the spot where you planted a single seed, doing all you know how to do to coax even a minuscule sprout to rise up, if that's where you are today, you have permission to shed all the tears that you need to shed. Lament as you need, unmasked and unashamed. Because if the psalmist is deemed reliable, then sorrow and grief may indeed become the ground of new life. Just please don't do it by yourself. There are people in this congregation who will get down there and help water those seeds with you. While you're down there on the grounds, it's as good a time as any to remember the Lenten mantra we mentioned earlier. Maybe we should all do that once in a while. From dust you are, and to dust you shall return. That phrase means something more to you now. Your cheek and the soil upon which your cheek rests are made up of the same elemental material. two becoming one. That phrase also leads us to trust that dust and tears and seed are the right mix of earth's common materials that God repurposes to cultivate something beautiful. Here is the insistent message of Lent. That God and Jesus took on our dustness, becoming human and living and laughing and weeping. And yes, even this, Jesus fell with his face to the ground and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yet not what I will, but as you will." Jesus did not want the suffering that the cross would bring. And he also knew that holy redemption moves through pain, not around it. So with all that he had, with all of his courage, with all of his love, with everything he was made up of, all of his oxygen, all of his carbon, all of his hydrogen, all of his nitrogen, all of his calcium, all his phosphorus, he placed all of his dustness into the hands of the master agriculturalist and said, "Have thine own way, Lord." If Jesus himself is any indication of what God can do with a dead life, or a dead church, or a dead world, as we shall see on Easter morning, then we must trust, as Jesus did, that God is, in love, redeeming a future beyond our disappointments, beyond our shame, beyond our sin. And God is about the work of restoring yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And by the surprising grace of God, our tears will become an abundance of joy. May that be so. And together we say, amen. Let's stand and worship together.
We are a moment, you are forever.